I do believe we're live.
Excellent. Hello, I'm Simon Mercer. It's time for another edition of Crave, the podcast about music, films, anything else which has been keeping me and Steve McCabe amused recently. We'll be looking today at The Dressmaker, the latest Australian film. What is it? What is it? That's the question. It's got Kate Winslet and Hugo Weaving, among others.
Simon's been to see Bridge of Spies.
And we've both been listening to Keith Richards' new solo album. But let's start, as usual, with films. The Dressmaker. Steve, is it an epic? Or is it just mad? Did you get it? What was it?
Well, am I allowed to go with both of the above?
Oh, okay.
It was all over the place, but in a fantastic and rather glorious way, I thought. I really enjoyed it.
Now tell me more, and we should explain more about how it was all over the place, because it was, I thought, more than one movie in one film, if you get what I mean. There were several types of film here, from a comedy to a heavy drama.
Just
paint the picture for us what it's all about.
Well, at the risk of launching straight into spoilers, and it's a very, very easy film to spoil, I think, this one, to be fair.
Yeah, true.
But basically, we have Kate Winslet as a very, very glamorous young woman who arrives back in a tiny little semi-desert village in somewhere in darkest Australia back in about 1951. And she's all glamorous and they're all backwater types. And she's a dressmaker. And she introduces culture to the village. But at the same time, there is some idea that she left because she had killed somebody. And as the film progresses, we start to uncover the truth of who she apparently killed and why she was run out of town as a small child. And her mother, played by an absolutely delightfully barking Mad Judy Davis,
who
steals every single scene she's in. She's phenomenal. Plays the mother who slowly comes around to accepting that this is her daughter, and memories are dredged up. And then after a thoroughly bonkers first half that to me brought to mind things like Tim Burton, for example. I saw definite scenes that could have been taken straight out of Edward Scissorhands, quite frankly. But without Danny Elfman, but rather with a classic Western score behind it.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk a bit about that first half. For most of that first half, Steve, I felt like I was in pretty much a comedy. I mean, you had larger than life characters, didn't you? The town constable, who's Hugo Weaving, who's
as
got
a cross dressing copper.
Yeah, that's right. He likes the chiffon, does old Hugo? And there's a number of other characters who are pretty larger than life, almost played in a caricature, really. And the Kate Winslet character is a little more somber,
yes,
but it's sort of the center of all these madcap characters whirling around. As you say, it's got that Western sort of setting. The township in outback Australia could be in the West, couldn't it?
Very definitely.
With the mother's house sitting at the top of the hill overlooking the township.
Yes.
It's rather a very forced, dramatic sort of setting. So here you are, la-di-da, lots of humor, laughter. The people where I was watching, there's a lot of laughter in the auditorium. And then the backstory starts to take over more and more, and the drama, it takes on a pretty dark hue. And without giving it away, Steve, there's a particularly serious, I thought, unexpected, dramatic event which really flips it on its head.
Yeah, I was afraid it was going to completely derail the film. I looked at my watch, I thought, we're halfway into this film now, and it's taken a very dark turn. Where on earth are we going?
Absolutely. I did not know what to make of it at that point. And then it carries on like that for a while.
Yes.
I don't think it gives too much away to say that at the beginning of the film, the Kate Winslet character, she comes back to town and she feels she might be cursed. And this idea of the curse carries all the way through, doesn't it?
She repeatedly remarks that I am cursed, I am cursed. And obviously that plays out through the course of the film. I think the Western references are worth repeating. Apparently, the director, Jocelyn Morehouse, has gone on record as saying that she sees it as Unforgiven with sewing machines.
And
I can see that. I mean, there's the whole revenge fantasy thing that's going on as the story progresses. There was one huge misstep in it that I thought. One thing that really didn't sit well. All the characters are very, very tightly drawn. There's a lot of... In a very, very brief appearance, you get to see so much in a character. The script is tart. The delivery is wonderfully arch. The costumes are glorious. Everything about it was fabulous. With one huge exception.
I know what you're going to say.
Who am I?
You're going to talk about Mr. Hemsworth, aren't you?
Liam Hemsworth.
Liam Hemsworth, yes.
Who is impossibly gorgeous, absolutely beautiful to look at, and has got the charisma of, well, quite frankly, one of Kate Winslet's sewing machines.
Come on, are his eyes really that blue? I was looking at him thinking, man, have you had some coloured contact lenses or what? That was just bizarre. Anyway. Well,
they were there for Kate Winslet's character, there for Tilly to get lost in, and that's all they were good for. It was a romantic thread that frankly didn't need to be there. And every time they drifted off into the romantic bit, it's like the film sort of put itself to sleep very slightly. The frankly barking nature of the film, the joyful ludicrousness of it suddenly got put on hold, and it became a very conventional romance.
Yeah,
very briefly.
Yeah. The romance does play into one of the ongoing themes about the cursed aspect, but I don't want to say too much more than that to give too much away. But so there is a bit of an involvement there with one of the themes of the film. But you're right. There's a lot of different things going on here.
Yeah.
And at the end, I kind of felt a bit confused, to be honest with you. I saw that part of the film and I enjoyed. Then I saw another sort of a film which was more heavy, and then at the end it's tried to somehow bring it all together. I don't think it quite pulled it off in that regard, although I enjoyed a lot of it. I don't think it quite sat there as a nice, I felt like I was watching something that really made a lot of sense from start to finish.
It was slightly pat resolution.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was fun. It was an enormously entertaining film. I mean, the cast, there were so many people just bopping around in the background who just tossed in lovely little bits. I mean, we have to mention again Hugo Weaving as Sergeant Farrett, who, I mean, there's one scene where he puts his feet up in Tilly's mother's house, in Mad Molly's house, and he just happens to be wearing ballet pumps. And nobody mentioned ballet slippers?
I don't know what they call them. Yeah.
The things that ballet dancers wear on their feet. There you go, those things. But he just happens to be wearing them as he puts his feet up. Nobody mentions it. Nobody remarks it. It's done on that level, and it works really, really well.
Yeah.
I thought that Guyton Grantley, who plays Liam Hemsworth's younger brother, now, what's an appropriate term to use?
He's disabled. He's mentally disabled.
Yeah. Back then they would have probably called him simple.
Yeah.
Now the last time I saw Guyton Grantley, he was playing Carl Williams in Underbelly several years ago.
Okay.
And I was quite taken with him then, but in this I was concerned to begin with. He was just sort of hamming it up, but by the end he actually turns in a very, very well-rounded performance. I was quite impressed.
Yeah.
He was very, very good. There was one scene toward the beginning that really gave me pause. One of the characters turns out to be a very, very unpleasant husband with a very, very slightly disturbed wife.
Yes.
And there's one scene that frankly looks like rape.
Yep, I saw. I saw that and I thought it just seemed so out of keeping with what else was going on in the story. I agree with you.
It was unnecessary.
Yes, it was. I suppose you could somehow say it was a hint of the darkness to come, but it really was a jolting thing to put in there. I agree. Yeah, totally. Look, just one other thing we should very quickly mention, Steve. It's called The Dressmaker, and the audience I was at, I don't know, 95% of the people there were women.
Okay.
And I suspect I shouldn't be sexist here, but I think that there was an interest in what the heck the dresses actually were, and they are some incredible costumes, aren't they? Just colourful and just fantastic. So it's got that going for it for sure.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, to be fair, it's kind of difficult to know how to pitch this film.
It is.
As we've already established, knowing what it is kind of difficult. And when I got my press screening invite, it's lovely pink pinstripes and buttons and needles, and it gives the impression that it's basically, you know, this is a woman's own magazine on the screen, and that doesn't do it justice. It's a lot more sophisticated and a lot more intelligent than a simple romantic comedy, and I think there's a degree to which it's been billed or promoted as a romantic comedy. It's a lot funnier than a straight drama. It's a lot darker than any rom-com's ever going to be.
Yes.
And I think with a film with this complexity, it's difficult to know how to pitch it.
It is. Would we buy a ticket? Would you recommend?
Most definitely.
I would too. I would too. For all the elements of confusion that you and I have discussed, it was incredible to look at. Some great performances. Boy, it takes you on a merry little dance of a way through all various types of genres of filmmaking.
Doesn't it just?
but yeah, well worth a view.
Most definitely. Now, Simon's been to see Bridge of Spies. I missed this one, so you're going to have to help me out here, Simon.
All right, I'll be brief. First of all, I really liked it. This is a Cold War drama, thriller, directed by Steven Spielberg, no less. I should mention it's from a screenplay co-written by the Coen brothers.
Oh.
So it's got some heft behind it, this film. It's basically the story of, based on a true story, back in the late 50s, 1960, the American spy pilot, Francis Gary Powers. He was his plane was shot down. He was captured by the Soviets, and he came to be part of a prisoner of Cold War swap with another guy, a Soviet spy called Rudolf Abel, who was captured by the FBI in New York. So that's the backdrop to the film, that story, and it centers on how the bloke who brokered the prisoner swap on the American side was a lawyer, and actually was an insurance lawyer by the name of James B. Donovan, and he is expertly played here by Tom Hanks. That's the central role in the film. The first part of the film is all about the Soviet guy getting captured, Rudolf Abel. He's in New York. The FBI grabs him. They got plenty of evidence against him, but they don't want to just sort of send him away without the semblance of a fair trial. So they say, American justice has got to be seen. The world's got to see that we do treat people the right way. We've got to at least go through the motions of a trial.
Right.
Let's get a lawyer to do it. They choose this guy, Donovan, who's Hanks. He knows it's not going to make him the most popular guy on the block, but he says, I've got to do it. He's a man of principle, and once he gets into this job, he thinks, I've got to do this properly, even though he thinks... He can see even the judge really doesn't care two hoots about this Soviet spy and is absolutely convinced of his guilt. Now, here's the interesting little thing that takes us into part two. James Donovan says to the judge, you can't kill him, judge. Hey, I'm an insurance lawyer. I know about preparing for risk, preparing for inevitabilities.
Right.
What happens if the Soviets capture one of our guys? Don't we want to sort of have something to trade with, something to barter with? We don't want to kill this guy. We might need him in the future. That's the insurance part of him talking.
Now, this has the potential, from everything you've told me,
to
be either really quite fascinating or the most astonishingly, crushingly dull, boring film I've ever seen. Which way does it go?
No, it goes very well. It wasn't boring. Partly because the craft of Steven Spielberg.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a beautifully put together film. The script is really crisp and clever.
Well, as you say, the Coen brothers, you really can't go far wrong there.
No. There's some wonderful acting. Hanks is just absolutely in his element here. And I should mention the spy, the Soviet spy called Abel, is played by, I think he's a British actor, Mark Rylance.
Mark Rylance, yes.
Yeah, he's superb. He plays this role in an understated but incredibly affecting way. And you actually feel incredible sympathy for him. And the relationship between the two men, the Soviet spy and the American lawyer, is really a central part of the story. So basically, Tom Hanks gets his spy off the death penalty. That proves to be incredibly important later on when the American pilot gets captured, and this latter part of the film takes you to Berlin, where Tom Hanks goes to broker the deal with the Soviets. Let's swap them over. And as you may recall, Steve, just a few weeks ago, I happened to be in Berlin.
So here's the personal connection right now. Excellent.
Yes. Having on this little expedition of mine and saw some of the scenes, the settings where the film has taken place. The film takes place as the wall is going up.
Oh, right.
Look, I think it's a really good job. It, in some ways, it could sound a bit dull, you know, lawyers and courtrooms and blah, blah, blah.
Well, insurance lawyers in particular, yes.
Exactly. But somehow what Tom Hanks does, I think he's done this in a few films now. I see him these days as he's kind of a James Stewart or Henry Fonda of modern American cinema. I was thinking of an old American film I'd seen a long time ago with Henry Fonda, set in a jury room called 12 Angry Men.
Now, that's a powerful title to invoke. Does he live up to it?
I think he pretty much. You know, 12 Angry Men was Henry Fonda was the one sole voice of reason in a jury room of others who are full of prejudice and just wanting to get home and blah, 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 blah. And that's kind of what we see unfolding with the Tom Hanks role here. He's... I guess we all kind of know who Tom Hanks is by these days. He is Tom Hanks, but he's I think he carries this off very, very well. I would really highly recommend it. I would definitely buy a ticket. One little downside for me was I think Spielberg overdoes the emotional sentimentality of the music. The score kind of tells you a bit too much what to feel here and there. I think that's a bit of cross. It's not a tick, but I would forgive him that, and I would give it a big plus.
I think, to be fair, that's a function of Steven Spielberg. I think I don't think he knows how to make a film that doesn't have that in it. And when we've got Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg together, I mean, to what extent is this simply Oscar bait?
Oscar bait. It probably is. I think... I mean, Hanks, he's got a couple of Oscars already to his name, hasn't he?
Exactly. So do you think he's maybe clearing a bit of space on the shelf to make room for another one?
Maybe. I think he is the central character. It is an ensemble sort of a cast. There are some other good actors there. I mentioned Mark Rylance, and there are others there too. It is Hanks's film.
Okay.
But it's kind of a role where he just has to stick to what his character's about. You see him at the beginning and he's the same guy at the end. So in that sense, it's not like a personal story of how he is changed by what he goes through. It just kind of, he reinforces his belief in the American way.
Right.
If I can put it like that.
Yeah.
So from that point of view, I'm not sure whether it's the arc of character development that might be Oscar worthy, but he does very well.
So it's not necessarily another Philadelphia or another Forrest Gump, then?
No, I don't think it's quite that. But he's impressive. In this role, he's very impressive, I thought.
Well, we'll tell me then. I've not seen it yet. Should I buy a ticket?
You should.
Well, one that I'm sure most people are going to want to buy tickets for, one of the most eagerly anticipated films in quite some time, is opening next week.
And lucky us, we're getting to see it.
Yeah, absolutely. We're obviously talking about the new James Bond film Spectre here, which has already opened to rave reviews across the UK.
I think The Guardian gave it 5 stars, but that's just The Guardian. we'll make up our own minds next week.
But what are we expecting? Are you a Bond fan yourself, Simon?
They were very much part of my childhood here. We used to see them. I remember seeing Sean Connery. I wasn't a Roger Moore sort of a fan. I lost some interest there. But I think Daniel Craig is, in my opinion, the best Bond.
Yes.
I think the films are grittier now and better for it. I think he plays it very well. The Skyfall was great. We've got good actors there now, good directors. The scripts are better. They've updated it, I think, really well. I'm tremendously looking forward to it. To the point, Steve, that as we've been seeing other films to review for Crave, and there's been a number of trailers for this film. I've tried very hard to put my head down and look at my notes and not look at the trailer, not to spoil it too much.
I've gone the other way. I've been drinking in everything I can find.
Right.
I can't wait. I'm with you on Skyfall. I think that's possibly the best Bond film to date.
Yeah.
And it's, and let's face it, you know, you're saying that Daniel Craig is the best Bond, and to say that he's even better than Sean Connery is brave, but I have to say, I think you might be onto something.
Well, I mean, I suppose Connery was the first. He made an absolutely massive impact.
Yes.
But it was played in a different way. It's probably a bit unfair, isn't it, to try and compare what was happening in the 60s with the late 2010s. But
I'll tell you what, if you go back now and rewatch something like, for example, my personal favourite from that era was You Only Live Twice. And yeah, it's dated and it's very definitely of its era, but it still holds up on its own. It's still a bloody good film. And you can say, I mean, okay, Diamonds Are Forever is dodgy beyond belief.
Yes.
But Dr. No and From Russia With Love, these are good films. These are really well-made films of their era.
Yeah.
And they're still worth watching even today. And Sean Connery just inhabits the role, and he inhabits his suits in the most wonderful way. He is leonine beyond belief. He's phenomenal.
And yeah.
But I was watching a Roger Moore the other night, just, you know, to wet the palate, and I watched Moonraker.
Oh, okay.
And I kind of wished I hadn't bothered, really, to be honest. You know, it was becoming a caricature. It really was. I know there's always been a certain degree of dark humour in these films, but he plays it far too camp.
Oh, very much so. I agree.
It's just utterly nonsense. And if you want to really see just how bad it got under James Bond, I'm not actually recommending that anyone does this unless they really have been bad and need punishing. Get yourself to see Live and Let Die.
Best
ever Bond theme tune, possibly worst ever Bond film. It is horrible. Not aged well in the slightest.
Hey, by the way, interesting to see, you know, you mentioned Skyfall, it's just a bit of a sidebar here. The theme song to Skyfall was sung by Adele.
Yes, it was.
And it won her an Oscar, by the way, didn't it? I think that's the only Bond theme to win an Oscar. And the world is waiting as we wait for the next Bond film. We're also waiting for the next Adele album.
Yes.
I saw that the first single called Hello is out there. It's had 150 million hits on YouTube in about a week. And there was something I saw in the British press, Steve. Other musical artists are deciding that they might avoid releasing their new material on or about November the 20th, which is when her album comes out, just because they know they would be just swept up in the juggernaut of attention on the new Adele album. So that's something we might look at in a few weeks' time.
I think we'll have to.
Yeah.
Interestingly, that's been going on for years. Famously, the Beatles and the Rolling Stones used to call each other up and say, "When's your next single coming out?"
Right.
Just because they knew that, you know, there's no sense competing.
No. Hey, speaking of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones,
effortless. consummate professional, Simon. That's what we are.
And we're getting better all the time. What's even better? Stones. It's Jagger and Richards, really, and in this case, just Richards.
Yes.
I just realised this latest album of his is his third solo album,
yes.
Cross-Eyed Heart. I haven't heard. I've been listening to it. I haven't listened to it all the way through, like a lot of times.
Yes.
So I'm still sort of on my initial impressions. First of all, you'd expect him to come from a bluesy, rocky sort of a place, wouldn't you?
Oh, very much so, yes.
And that's where this is. This is superbly produced, I thought. And yeah, I thought it was pretty good. I did. What do you think?
I have long believed that there's only one Rolling Stone who's allowed to make a solo album. And this is it, obviously. It's his third, it's his best. The first two were okay. I wonder why. When you're playing with Mick Jagger and Ron Wood, and especially with Charlie Watts, why you would then want to go off and play with anybody else? It does feel a bit like cheating on the wife, to be fair. But what he's produced is a very, very agreeable, very pleasant album. I like it. It's very polished. It's very good. It feels a little bit unnecessary.
Ah, that's a very Yeah, that's a very interesting word, because I guess when you have an older guy talking and sort of those sort of bluesy lyrics, the stories are stories we've all heard before.
Yes.
And it's just like it's just really a matter of, yeah, you're not going to be surprised necessarily by anything here. It's a matter of whether Richard's, who he is, means enough to you that the way he does this, the fact that he's doing it at all, just takes you somewhere pleasant for a while. I agree with you. I want to talk just quickly about his voice.
Yes.
I had a few issues with it myself. He doesn't have a strong voice by any means. I guess we would all know that anyway. And I think he uses it in different ways. Sometimes he is genuinely singing. Other times there's almost a semi-Mark Knopfler type of half talking his way through a song, I thought,
yeah,
almost.
Yeah, I think Amnesia, the third track on the album, is a classic example of that, where it's as though he's telling a story. It makes huge, it invites parallels and comparisons with Bill Wyman's effort from a couple of months ago, which was possibly the most pointless solo album of all time. You know, most Rolling Stones fans are just being quietly allowing Wyman to just go and sit in the corner and be quiet. And he opened his album with something called with Who and What and Where and When and the most important question, why?
Right.
And that was an attempt to tell a story, and it was just clunkingly, cringingly awful. Whereas Amnesia, which is Keith Richards' answer to that, is altogether more engaging. The man's got, he's got a voice. Good yeah. voice or bad voice, altogether other conversation, but he's got a very distinctive voice. It's a lived-in voice.
It's absolutely. And
you can hear 50 years of abuse in that voice. You really can. And I think he pulls it off really nicely. What I did appreciate was the fact that you can actually hear his voice. I am a big, big Stones fan. And so I listen to, for example, songs like Before They Make Me Run from Some Girls, which is one of my favourite Keith songs from Stones albums of days gone by. And it's a cracking song. He played it when they were in Auckland last year. But on Some Girls, you can barely even hear his voice. You can
right.
He's a backing singer on his own track. His voice is so far back in the mix. Whereas here, they've said, okay, this is a Keith album. You need to be able to hear him. And so he's front and centre. You can hear him really clearly. I mean, remember, this is the fella who was actually in the choir in St. Paul's Cathedral at the Queen's coronation.
I had forgotten that. Yeah. You're right. I think you're absolutely right that it's that lived-in quality that comes through. By the way, you mentioned backing singers. He's got the likes of Norah Jones and Aaron Neville here along for the ride. So there's some pretty nice-sounding music here.
Oh, yes.
They're almost all original songs on this album, 15 tracks, so it's a pretty full album. I actually quite enjoyed the cover. I don't know why I enjoyed this, but the cover version of a really old song, the old Lead Belly, Good Night Irene.
A lot of people are calling that one out as being the standout track on
I don't know why. I thought initially, you're kidding me. Why is this here? But I just really liked it. Anyway.
It works better than it should, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And you mentioned cover versions. What I did found troubling was, I was listening to songs like, for example, Robbed Blind is a nice little acoustic thing. And basically, it's New Faces from Voodoo Lounge. Trouble. I've listened to it a dozen times now. I still can't figure out exactly which of his older riffs he's recycled for it.
Yeah.
But it's basically the essence of the Rolling Stones distilled down without Mick and Charlie.
You're absolutely right. There are some, you hear some guitar, the progression of the chords and some of the rockier numbers especially.
Oh, yes.
It's just, wow, there they are. There's the Stones right there.
Mid to late period Stones riffs by the numbers. And I mean, who else can do it better? I mean, he's basically, this is Keith Richards as his own tribute act.
That's a nice way of putting it. So in terms of recommending this, I think I would. Yes, I would.
You would, wouldn't you? Yeah, definitely want to download. I mean, I'm just looking. I have the picture up on my computer screen right now, and it's got Keith with a dirty, great big smile on his face. It's a black and white photo where they've obviously warmed up the contrast, and you can see crags and crevices deep in the Grand Canyon. And look at the picture, and the picture basically tells you exactly what you're about to hear for the next 45 minutes. It's lovely.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. They nailed the cover photo.
Yeah, now, don't expect any new ground to be broken. If you're looking for a new Sympathy for the Devil or a new Gimme Shelter, this is the wrong place to look. If you're looking for something to really, really enjoy, yeah, you can't go far wrong with Keith, can you?
Off the streets again. So, a tick there for Cross-Eyed Heart, solo album from Keith Richards. Now, just quickly before we go, McCabe.
You forgot my name there. You forgot my name for a second, didn't you? It's all right. You forgot your own name last week.
I'm on a roll. What's this called? Crave. It's called Crave. That's where we are. Yes. Hey, mostly we talk about movies. We talk about music, TV. I'm just very, very quickly, I know time's getting on, but I just wanted to mention a book I've just finished, just quickly. It's the latest book in this ongoing story of Lisbeth Salander. This is the girl with the dragon tattoo.
What else has she done? She's had a dragon tattoo. She's kicked hornet's nests, I believe.
Yes. And there was another. She's kicked hornet's nests and she's played with fire.
That's the one, yes.
So there were three novels written by the Swedish author Stieg Larsson. They were hugely successful. They swept the world. They sold millions of copies. They were turned into films. He died in 2004. And was that the end of it? Well, another Swedish author called David Lagercrantz, I think that's how you say it, with a different translator, it's probably worth mentioning, has come along with the latest edition called The Girl in the Spider's Web.
Is this not very brave, taking over a dead author, a beloved dead author's characters?
I think it is incredibly brave. I note in the acknowledgements he thanks Stieg Larsson's brother and father. So there's been some sort of a consultation here and a blessing, I guess.
Yeah.
And I think he does a fantastic job. I think he actually has nailed the tone of what Stieg Larsson was all about. He's brought back all the characters, Lisbeth Salander. I mean, she's an amazing character. I don't know if you've actually read these before, Steve.
No, I haven't, and I know I should.
Okay, well, she is a super intelligent, emotionally crippled young woman. She's driven by a fierce sense of justice, and she also happens to be perhaps the best computer hacker in the world and an expert in self-defense.
Of course.
And she's got a massive dragon tattoo on her back. And her partner, through much of this, all these stories, is an investigative journalist called Mikael Blomqvist, who, by the way, Daniel Craig played in an English language version, just to bring it back to Daniel Craig for a second.
Yes, that does sound familiar.
But look, this is another chapter. It's very much taking the story on into the age of international surveillance, and it's all about the infringement of privacy and of corruption. I would just say that this new author, I actually think, is a better writer than Stieg Larsson.
Wow.
I enjoyed the story that Stieg Larsson did before. I read the previous books. I didn't think he was the best writer in the world.
Right.
But this guy is, I think, a cleaner writer, and he paces the story superbly well. He goes from scene to scene and from one set of characters to other superbly, picks up the pace as you go through the book, and you're left breathless by the end. If you liked the previous books, I think you'll really like this one. I mean, it's not everyone's cup of tea, but a big, big tick for me for this one. It's David Lagercrantz, The Girl in the Spider's Web.
I'll tell you what, if I ever actually manage to get the Luminaries finished, that's going top of my list next.
Fantastic. When you were
young and your heart... Next time on Crave... We're going to be back with our verdict on Spectre.
Looking forward to that.
Oh, it's going to be so good, isn't it? I mean, do we even need to review it? Should we just say right now it's fantastic?
Well, I tell you, one thing I'm particularly looking forward to seeing is, and his name's just gone out of my head, the fantastic German actor who'll be playing the baddie this time.
Christoph
Waltz, who has been superb in other roles.
Now, you must have seen a trailer with him in it, surely.
I have seen the trailer, and just that... says the word James. I think it's delivered so beautifully.
Yes. He could possibly be the definitive Bond villain, couldn't he?
He could. I think I'm can't wait to see how he does his role. I think it's going to be fantastic. So, yes, that's next time. So, and what about this music we're going to see next week?
We also have tickets to see Hozier on Thursday night. Now, this one's an interesting one. He's an Irish blues rock singer whose music is very sparse, very cut back. He's absolutely beautiful. He's got a phenomenally rich voice. He has one album out, and he's playing Vector Arena.
Now, that's not bad. You might expect a guy with one album might to end up in a much smaller venue, but they've obviously decided to take a punt. Maybe it's not a punt. Maybe they know they're on a winner here.
Well, I gather it's sold out. We're very lucky to have scored tickets. I have a feeling this is going to be... And let's face it, Robbie Williams is in town two nights earlier. I have a feeling Hozier is going to be the big show of the week. Take me to church, I worship like a dog at the shrine of your life. I'll tell you my sins and you can sharpen your knife. Offer me that deathless death, the good God, let me give you my life. Take me to church, I worship like a dog at the shrine of your life. I'll tell you my sins and you can sharpen your knife. Offer me that deathless death, the good God, let me give you my life.
Fantastic. Look forward to that. Hozier on Crave next time, as will be our review of Spectre. So that's about it, isn't it, for now, Steve?
I think that'll do for this week.
Okay. Absolutely. So if you want to email us, by the way, you're very, very welcome. We'll look forward to hearing from you. You can email us at podcast@cravepodcast.com.
You can find us on Facebook, or you can follow us on Twitter @CravePodcast.
So I'm Simon Mercer.
I'm Steve McCabe.
That's what's been entertaining us this week. See ya.
Fantastic. Does it half as good as you?